there's a new film coming out this year. Some people are excited about it, but not too many are. It's called Oz, the Great and Powerful. And it's a prequel to The Wizard of Oz. It's going to tell the story of how The Wizard of Oz became such a powerful figure. Now, I'm sure all of you have seen the original. And so we know that even though there'll be many powerful and great things that happen in the film, the irony of the title is that The Wizard of Oz is actually just a pretty normal guy. There's nothing too great or too powerful about him. And so in the original film, we watch it every Christmas, Dorothy, the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and the Cowardly Lion, they all trek to the castle to find the Wizard of Oz, hoping that he can give them everything they need, a heart, a brain, courage, or a way home. But when they get into the presence of the Wizard of Oz and they pull back the curtain, they get a shock. Because when they pull back the curtain, they see that the wizard isn't really a wizard at all. And that he arrived in Oz by fluke, and he's blagged his way ever since. They had set all their hopes in him, thinking, this is the Wizard of Oz. He will be able to solve all of our problems. But when they pulled back the curtain and saw him for who he really was, well, he wasn't as great or as powerful as they once thought. In many ways, in our passage tonight, we've begun to pull back the curtain on King David. And as we pull it back, we see that he isn't as special as we might have thought he was. Up to now, in 1 and 2 Samuel, David had been an all-conquering hero. He was anointed by Samuel as God's chosen king. He defeated the giant Goliath. He becomes the king of Israel despite the jealousy of Saul and his attempts on his life. David wins battle after battle, and he is named as a man after God's own heart. If anyone is a hero, surely it's King David. If anyone seems great and powerful, it's David. But yet, in our two chapters tonight, we pull back the curtain and we see that David is every bit as sinful and destructive as any of us can be. We pull back the curtain and tonight we see a man who, rather than going after God's own heart, goes after his own lusts and desires. Now, up to now, the pace in the book has been fairly frantic. We've had battle after battle with stories in between, and in some ways, maybe it's just me, it's been quite difficult to keep up with. It's been difficult to know all that's happening, because there's one thing after another, after another, after another. But in our two chapters tonight, the pace of the book is slowed right down. And we focus on this one story with David. The Israelites are still at war. All of the battles are still taking place. But the focus shifts from that to the king himself. And the result is twofold. First of all, it makes us more aware of David's sin. And then secondly, it makes us appreciate even more God's grace. So we'll start by looking at chapter 11. First of all, the chapter opens and David falls into sin. It's as simple as that. When we look at what happened last week, well, in chapter 9, we see David showing grace and mercy to Mephibosheth. In chapter 10, David thought, you know, I will show kindness to Hanun, son of Nahash, just as his father showed kindness to me. And so last week we looked at David and we saw this upright character. But in verses 1 to 4 of chapter 11, we see how far he is from that character. David gets up, goes to the balcony or the window and he surveys his kingdom. And when he looks, he sees Bathsheba. He sees her bathing and he likes what he sees. There's no suggestion in the text that Bathsheba is bathing to attract him. There's no suggestion that she's trying to lure and admire. But all we know is that David catches a glimpse, and he likes what he sees. And so he sends for her, and then he sleeps with her. His lust takes over completely. He doesn't try to woo her. There's no suggestion of any sort of romantic gesture or relationship. This isn't some sort of romantic comedy. He sees something he wants. He sends for her and he sleeps with her. This is the man who was God's chosen king. This is the man who is after God's own heart. And yet here he is in the text, falling deep into instinctive, instant, destructive sin. Now you note that this just isn't any other girl, but it tells us that Bathsheba is the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah. Now later on in chapter 23, we find out more about who these guys are. And when we read that, we find out that Bathsheba is the daughter of one of David's very best warriors. We find out that Bathsheba is the granddaughter of one of David's most trusted counselors. And we discover that Bathsheba is the wife of one of David's inner circle of soldiers. But he doesn't care. He doesn't care about anything other than he sees something he wants and he has his way with her. Victory after victory for God's chosen king. And then we come to this point. And look at how instantly it all changes and he falls into sin. I want to pause here for a quick point of application. Because when we're reading the story, we should be surprised by David's sin. But we shouldn't be so naive as to think we could never do anything like that ourselves. Now, some of you, I'm pretty sure, won't fall easily into adultery. But falling into sin happens to all of us. Whenever I was taking a year out in between school and university, I was convinced, and I still am, that God had called me to go down to the church in Fermoy in County Cork. And before I went, we had a commissioning service in Bloomfield, and I stood up and I shared with everyone how I was going to Fermoy because I was convinced that this is what God had called me to do. And people were pretty impressed with this young man being so obedient to God's call, and my head was this size. But yet, on that very same night, and I don't say this flippantly, this doesn't happen very often, but on that very same night, God called me to change something else in my life before I made that journey. And I didn't. I completely ignored him. People thought that night I was so great. They thought I was following God. But as I was following God in one way, I was turning my back on him in another. And that ended up having a negative impact on my whole year away. I was going for God and then fell instantly into sin. Falling into sin is easy to do. I'm pretty sure you know that as well as I do. Even when we feel like we're doing things right, we're going on the right track, one bad instant decision, and that changes. So don't look at David's story tonight and think that could never be you. But be careful, because if a man after God's own heart can fall into such destructive sin, then so can you. Be on your guard. Last week, Ben chose all of the hymns that I wanted to sing tonight, including Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing. And there's a line in there that every honest Christian can really identify with, and that's, "Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love." We all know that sometimes we fall easily and instantly into sin. Be on your guard. Back to the story. So David falls into sin. Secondly, he then falls into a downward spiral. And the story continues in verses 5 to 25, and it gets worse. The woman conceived and sent word to David saying, "I am pregnant." So he starts by trying to cover his sin up. He sends for Uriah, Bathsheba's husband, and he calls him back to Jerusalem from the battlefield. Now, Uriah, as I said, is one of David's key soldiers, and so he's probably wondering why David brought him all the way back in the middle of battle. And then when he gets here, it's just so he can find an update, so he's probably pretty surprised. Now, David's plan is that he'll get an update from Uriah and then send him home to his wife. He's been off fighting for a long time, and so when he gets home, he'll want to go and be with his wife. And then when it is revealed that she is pregnant, everyone will believe that the child is Uriah's. He has the perfect plan to cover up his sin. Only it doesn't work. Because Uriah is a man of honor, and in a move of camaraderie with the rest of his soldiers who haven't got the chance to come home, he refuses to go back to his homely comforts. And instead, he sleeps in the doorway. So David gets frustrated. And the next day, he tries to get Uriah drunk so that he'll forget about his camaraderie and he'll go home to his wife. But again, it doesn't work. And Uriah sleeps among the servants instead of going back to his wife. So David's caught in this sin. And he's getting more and more frustrated. And he can't see a way out. And so he sends a note back with Uriah to the commander Joab. And what Uriah carries back to the battlefield is his own death sentence. David instructs Joab to place Uriah on the front line where he is certain to be killed. David sinned. David couldn't cover up his sin, so David sins again by ordering Uriah to be killed. Now this whole chapter, the whole focus is on David. We don't hear about Bathsheba, whether she wanted to do that or not. We don't hear about what Joab thinks of the plan. We don't hear from Uriah. It's all about David. But have you noticed who else we haven't heard from yet in the chapter? And what is the ultimate outcome of David's sin? If you have a Bible, look at verse 27. "But the thing David had done displeased the Lord." Above everything else, the biggest consequence here isn't that there is a child, isn't that Uriah is going to die, but it is that David has displeased the Lord. David, God's chosen king, David, a man after God's own heart, David has displeased the Lord. And the worst thing is, he barely realizes it. A more literal translation could be, "The thing David has done was evil in the Lord's eyes." But what is it in David's eyes? Well, look at the message he sends to Joab. In verse 25, he says, "Look, don't let this upset you. The sword devours one as well as the other. Look, it's no big deal. It's just one of those things. Let's move on." David thinks he's gotten away with it. But when we see God's reaction, we see how wrong he is. Make sure you realize the implication here for our lives as well. Sometimes we think that sin isn't serious because nobody gets badly hurt. What we are reminded here is that when we sin, God is always the most offended party. Because sin isn't just doing something wrong, but sin is going against God's will. So that's chapter 11. And chapter 11 makes us very aware of the sin in David's life. And I hope that it makes you aware of the sin in your life as well. That as you look at David, you don't think, well, that could never be me. But you look at David and you see where you too have fallen so very short. So we'll move on quickly to chapter 12 and see what happens when God shows up. I have a memory of mine from whenever I was younger, and I can't remember the whole story, but it sticks with me for some reason. And I think somebody was leaving and I wanted to say goodbye, but I had no shoes on. So I quickly threw on my dad's shoes, which were about four sizes too big for me, and I ran out into the street to chase after them to say goodbye. But because they were about four sizes too big, I tripped up and I fell, and I cut my knees and I cut my hands, and I cried like a baby, I'm sure, and I was miserable. But the reason I remember that is because as soon as I got up, I panicked. I didn't panic about being hurt. I panicked that I thought I'd get inside and my dad would tell me off for being so stupid as to wear his shoes. I went inside, and I'm sure he did teach me a lesson and say, be careful next time, wear your own shoes. But I don't remember that. All I remember is that he picked me up, he looked after me, and he made me feel better. I was expecting to be told off. Instead, I got looked after. And in one sense, that happens here. As we see God's disappointment at the end of chapter 11, we're expecting chapter 12 to be full of God's wrath and God's righteous judgment and David giving him the punishment that he deserves. But instead, when God shows up, we get grace. He does this by doing four things and not doing a fifth. First of all, God shows up. God takes the initiative. It opens the Lord sent Nathan to Jonathan. No, it doesn't. It opens the Lord sent Nathan to David. God doesn't leave David alone to wallow in his sin, but God pursues him. God makes the first move in sorting the situation out by sending his prophet. Secondly, God reveals David's sin to him. When Nathan arrives, he doesn't rebuke him straight away, but he slowly works on David's heart so that whenever David is rebuked, he understands why and he accepts it. Let's look at verses 1 to 4. The Lord sent Nathan to David. When he came to him, he said, there were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb he had bought. He raised it and it grew up with him and his children. It shared his food, drank from his cup, and even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Now a traveller came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveller who had come to him. Instead, he took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come. And what's David's, King David, what's his reaction to this story? Well, he burned with anger. David knew what justice was. This man deserves to die, David said. Nathan tells a story to make sure that David completely understands why what he did was wrong before he confronts him with the reality of it. And so as soon as David condemns the man, Nathan makes it clear, you are that man. God rebukes. Nathan said to David, you are the man. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave your master's house to you and your master's wives into your arms. I gave you the house of Israel and Judah, and if all this had been too little, I would have given you even more. He's like the rich man with all the cattle and with all of the lambs. But yet he took someone else's. God gave him everything. He had no reason to have to go after Bathsheba. He had his own wives. God gave him everything. And God rebukes. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? You struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword and took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. He makes it completely clear to David what his sin is. And then in verses 10 to 12, he tells him the results of that sin. Now therefore the sword will never depart from your house, because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own. This is what the Lord says: out of your own household I am going to bring calamity upon you. Before your very eyes I will take your wives and give them to one who is close to you, and he will lie with your wives in broad daylight. You did it in secret, but I will do this thing in broad daylight before all Israel. Now let's think very quickly about what David really deserved here. If we're going by the letter of the law, Leviticus chapter 20 verse 10 reads, if a man commits adultery with another man's wife, with the wife of his neighbor, both the adulterer and the adulteress must be put to death. Or if we look at Deuteronomy chapter 22 verse 22, if a man is found sleeping with another man's wife, both the man who slept with her and the woman must die. And so it's obvious what David deserves. And as he hears this rebuke, after having understood from the story what he's done, he grasps fully for the first time what he has done. David deserves death. He becomes aware of this, and in verse 13 he says, I have sinned against the Lord. But the fourth thing that God does is that he shows grace. The Lord has taken away your sin. You are not going to die. David deserves death, but by God's grace, he receives life. God shows grace. And we don't have time to work through all of verses 14 to 25. But the fifth thing that God doesn't do is that he doesn't remove all the consequences of sin. And so if you run your eyes over those verses, you'll see that the child that got them into all this trouble dies after its birth. David is forgiven, but the consequences of his sin on this earth aren't taken from him. And so he still suffers as a result. And so just as an aside, please remember that for yourself as well, that in Jesus we can be forgiven of all our sins and we rejoice in that. But that doesn't mean that we will not suffer as a result of our sin. So we've covered a lot. And let's try to take a breath and review it all. Chapter 11 makes us aware of David's sin and of our own. We saw how, first of all, no matter how well we think we're doing, if we're not on guard, we can fall easily into sin like David did. We saw how that sin spiraled out of control and led to further sin. And then finally, we were reminded that the most offended party when we sin is always God. But then in chapter 12, we were made aware of God's grace, of how God made the first move, of how God slowly revealed the sin, of how God honestly rebuked David, and how although God didn't remove all of the consequences of sin, he did show grace. I'm going to read verses 26 to 31. Meanwhile, Joab fought against Rabbah of the Ammonites and captured the royal citadel. Joab then sent messengers to David saying, I have fought against Rabbah and taken its water supply. I muster the rest of the troops and besiege the city and capture it. Otherwise, I shall take the city and it will be named after me. So David mustered the entire army and went to Rabbah and attacked and captured it. He took the crown from the head of their king. Its weight was a talent of gold, and it was set with precious stones, and it was placed on David's head. He took a great quantity of plunder from the city and brought out the people who were there, consigning them to labor with saws and with iron picks and axes, and he made them work at brick making. He did this to all the Ammonite towns. Then David and his entire army returned to Jerusalem. Where did that bit come from? You're reminded all of a sudden that there's still a war going on here. There's still a battle happening. And as I got caught up in the story of David and Bathsheba, I kind of forgot about that. And in many ways, these verses at the end of that chapter seem almost a bit irrelevant and a bit anticlimactic when compared to the story that we've just thought about. We don't really care about the battle. We care about David, and we care about the story between him and Bathsheba and Uriah and Joab. So why is that? Why, whenever we've paid so much attention to the battles in the past few weeks, why do we no longer care as much as we did? I think it's because we've seen David now for who he really is. We've seen that he is human and that he is weak. And that as a result, this kingdom that he's building that was so exciting, well, it just doesn't seem as impressive anymore. In The Wizard of Oz, you spend the whole film looking forward to meet the wizard. And when the curtain is pulled back, he suddenly doesn't seem quite as exciting. And what we've seen here tonight is that David is simply an earthly king. And all earthly kings falter, fail, and fade. At the end of the chapter, he gets a new gold crown. But he doesn't have that gold crown anymore. All earthly kingdoms have their time and then they pass. And so as we see the humanity of King David, we are made aware of the frailty of his kingdom. And so the story loses a bit of its excitement. But remember the name of our series. Because what is important about David's story is not his earthly crown of gold, but the fact that he is crowned with grace. Now, you may not have committed adultery or ordered a murder, but you have sinned. I have sinned. We have all sinned. And we all, like David, need to be crowned with grace. We can all, like David, slip so easily into sin. But thankfully, just like with David, God made the first move with us. He didn't leave us to our own devices. He didn't leave us to wallow in our sin, but he sent Jesus. He sent Jesus to live the life that we couldn't live and to die the death that we deserve, so that through faith in him, we can experience not death, but the gift of eternal life. Do not look at David's story tonight naively thinking that you can do a better job than him. But rather, instead, look to the grace that the story points to. Rather, instead, look to the only king whose crown doesn't fade. Look to Jesus. And so when God reveals the sin in your life to you, look to him for grace and forgiveness. Tonight in our series, it is the start of trouble for King David. And if you've looked on the church website at the image that we use for this series, you'll see that it's a rusty old crown. And that's because David's earthly crown fades. But what doesn't fade is the crown of grace offered to us. Grace that gave David life instead of death. And grace that through Christ offers the same to you.